Spring is my favorite time to start a new workout routine. With the weather warming up, it feels easier to get into the rhythm of things. Whether you have 20 minutes or an hour for a Pilates class or outdoor guided walk, Peloton has everything you need to help you get going. Get a head start on summer with Peloton at onepeloton.com.
Hello, I'm David Badil.
And I'm Saeeda Farsi. And welcome to A Muslim and a Jew Go There.
And we're back talking about our core issues of anti-Semitism and Islamophobia this week. We're going to begin by talking about what I'm going to call hashtag Gideon Faltergate and the whole scenario of the various videos that have been circulating on the internet of that incident and what it means for policing.
And we're also going to be talking about a video that's circulating about an alleged anti-Muslim racist stroke Islamophobic incident in London, where, amongst other things, the perpetrator told two women who looked like they had been to a peace march, a pro-Palestinian march, he told them to, excuse my language, fuck off back to Muslim. And we're also going to be talking about yet another report about Islamophobia by a think tank who keeps telling us that we shouldn't have a definition for Islamophobia. So I think the big themes, aren't they, today, David, are going to be what is and what isn't anti-Semitism and what isn't Islamophobia.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure that fuck off back to Muslim is Islamophobic. I mean, you know, I'm not a Muslim, but I'm going to put my cards on the table, Saeeda, and say I'm pretty sure that qualifies.
I was going to say, these are really serious incidents, right? But I can't help but laugh at the ignorance. I would say that the one thing worse than a racist is actually a thick racist. I remember when, you know, it's like you being called the P word, you know, and it's like the EDL using the word Muslimic. So, yeah. So the Muslimics are being told to F off back to Muslim, whatever that is.
It is serious. At the same time, racism is always hilarious because it's always stupid and it's always absurd. And so there's no harm in laughing at a man who says, fuck off back to Muslim, as well as saying that he's a twat. Let's talk about someone else who's possibly a bit of a twat. We'll be discussing more or less that, which is this person who's become kind of famous in the last week or so, certainly online, which is this man, Gideon Falter. Now, we have discussed him before. We should probably say this in full transparency, that a couple of podcasts ago, the campaign against anti-Semitism, which he runs, did have a go at you, Saeeda. So we should probably say that up front in terms of any opinions we may give about him and his behaviour.
Yeah, I agree. And I think in some ways I'm now in great company because the campaign against anti-Semitism have had a go at Sadiq Khan, have had a go at me, have now had a go at the Met Police, the Met Commissioner, Dame Margaret Hodge, the daughter of a Holocaust survivor, Lord Mann, the government's advisor on anti-Semitism. So they do have a history of having a go.
Yeah.
And I think what this incident is about is, what was Gideon Falter? Just a man walking through London, visibly Jewish, and got caught up in this? Or was he out there having a go?
Well,
was he out there to provoke?
Let's go over it very quickly. Most people may know about it, but let's very quickly go over what happened. Gideon Falter, in his capacity, I think, as head of the campaign against anti-Semitism, who were the organisation who organised the sole march that has happened in London, which is not a march in favour of Palestinian solidarity, but a march that was called against anti-Semitism, that I did attend. That organisation, which he runs, released a video on their Twitter feed, which was basically him saying and showing that he'd gone to one of these marches. And I actually watched his original video, I don't know if anyone else watched that, in which he sort of presented the film, in which he said he'd just gone to synagogue and then doing what he suggested he always does. I think there's an issue there, but we'll come back to it. He just went for a walk with his friends, wearing his yarmulke, which is the same as a kippah. It's basically the skull cap that religious Jews wear. And just happened to bump in to a Palestine march. And that's when the police stopped him, according to him, and wouldn't let him sort of just walk across the road. And the famous bit of the video that he showed is a police officer saying to him that he can't walk across the road in the face of these protesters because he is openly Jewish.
And what has subsequently come to light is a 13-minute video. And I would urge listeners to go and watch that 13-minute video because I think it gives a much broader context of what happened on that day. But obviously, off the back of this encounter, accusations of anti-Semitism were made, which resulted in an apology from the Met Police, which was then deleted. And then a further apology to the apology was put out.
Just to be clear what happened there, they posted a very long apology, in which they say the use of the term openly Jewish by one of our officers is hugely regrettable. And it was a poor choice of words, all that stuff. But then they say in recent weeks we've seen a new trend emerge with those opposed to the main protest appearing along the route. It says the fact that the people who do this, filming themselves, they must know that their presence is provocative, like they're inviting response, and that's increasing the likelihood of an altercation and making it much likely that officers will intervene. So I think I need to bring that up because that is the statement that they then deleted following outrage or whatever, protests on Twitter, mainly from Jews, saying that essentially they were apologising but not apologising, as some people do when they apologise publicly. They say, oh, I'm sorry about this, but, and then there's much more after the but than before the but. And so the second apology was a bit more just like, we're sorry and, you know, we shouldn't have done this and we hope to have the confidence of Jewish Londoners. They've apologised for the openly Jewish bit, but, you know, they're trying to do their best to police London. So that is, I think, where we are as we speak.
Yep. And I think for me in this story, there are a number of questions that we need to be asking, David. One, who is Gideon Falter and who are the Campaign Against Anti-Semitism? And Campaign Against Anti-Semitism say on their own material that their aim is to tackle, quote, anti-Semitism disguised as anti-Israel public discourse, end quote. And we've dealt with this in a previous podcast, but it is really interesting that the connections that they have to organisations like the Jewish National Fund, which is a charity which is involved with land development and its association with settlements in Israel, but also organisations like Hashoma Hashadash, I hope I've pronounced that right, which is an organisation in Israel about whom an investigation was published by Haaretz, an Israeli newspaper, which found that the group played a key role in defending multiple settler outposts. There is well-documented evidence out there about the relationship between Campaign Against Anti-Semitism, the various people involved in Campaign Against Anti-Semitism, and their links to Israel, including Israeli settlements. And so the question is the Campaign Against Anti-Semitism campaigning against anti-Semitism, or is the Campaign Against Anti-Semitism there to be pro-Israeli and to shut down anything that they consider to be pro-Palestinian? And one of the concerns that I had was that what Gideon Falter was trying to do was trying to prove that there are no-go zones for Jews. And one of the concerns that I had was that this concept of no-go zones, which has been popularized by people like Suella Braverman and others, is an anti-Muslim trope.
So here's what I think, more or less, although I am working this out as I speak, which is unquestionably Gideon Falter needs some media training. I mean, I don't know if there's anyone I can think of who comes across quite so badly, both in his own films and in interviews that I've seen. And unquestionably, the Campaign Against Anti-Semitism is pro-Israel. They have chosen to call themselves the Campaign Against Anti-Semitism. It seems to me, as far as I can make out, that almost everything they do is involved with the notion that being Jewish involves identifying with Israel and all the rest of it. I do not agree with you, really, and I don't agree with you in general, philosophically, that it matters that much who they are in this particular case. Because what I think is, all that is true. He's an annoying bloke. He's a provocateur. The Campaign Against Anti-Semitism are odd, a bit dodgy, not liked by the mainstream Jewish establishment, not liked by the liberal Jewish establishment. He still did something which I think is of value, and I think it's of value because it brings something up, whatever the rights and wrongs, and there are quite a lot of wrongs, in how he did it. And that is that it is intimidating for Jews to be around those marches if they are not, and this is a key thing, self-professed part of the block of Jews. This keeps on being brought up by people like Ben Jamal, who is director of the Palestine Solidarity Campaign. If they're not part of the block of Jews who go along to support the marches and to be pro-Palestinian Jews. So it's not as simple as just saying, oh, it's fine, as a lot of people have. It's fine for Jews to be at the marches because, look, here are these Jews who are welcome. Those are only Jews who are considered to have the right opinions by the marches. Something else that needs to be said is it is clearly not true that Gideon Falter just went for a walk. And I don't know why he says stupid things like that. However, to be fair to him, he was not waving an Israeli flag. He didn't go there, you know, shouting as a counter-protester and trying to say things, anything pro-Israeli. He kind of cosplayed, even though that is him, as a Jew who happens to be wearing a yarmulke. And it then seems to me odd that policeman felt that in itself was a reason for him not to be allowed near the march. If he had been, I think you described it in a separate conversation we had as being like from a different football team, you wouldn't go in as a Man United fan into a Man City end. That would be true if he was waving an Israeli flag and carrying a picture of Benjamin Netanyahu as if he was a massive fan. He turns up at that march just as a Jew with a kappel on. As such, he should be allowed to cross the road.
Okay, so I both agree and disagree with you. I'll tell you where I agree with you. We have to recognise that anti-Semitism is a real issue and a growing issue, and that there have been incidents on these peace marches, very tiny amount of incidents, which could be classified as anti-Semitism. Let's just keep, you know, remind ourselves again of something that we brought up in a previous podcast, that the fact that millions and millions of people have cumulatively over the last 6 months taken to the streets of the United Kingdom in relation to these peace protests, and yet the number of arrests still do not go anywhere near, for example, the number of arrests at Glastonbury Festival. And so I think that's important to put that out there. However, recognising that anti-Semitism is a real issue, I also think we need to recognise that there are bad faith actors out there who weaponise anti-Semitism. And at that point, it is important to look at who the people are who are making these calls of anti-Semitism. And for me, it's not just about the campaign against anti-Semitism or Gideon Falter being pro-Israeli. It's their associations with some of the most extreme and right-wing sections of Israel. For example, the organization that I was speaking about, Hashomer Hashadash, I hope I'm pronouncing that right, they, amongst others, platformed an extreme right-wing politician, Ben Gavir, who is, by the way, a convicted terrorist. So I think you have to be judged by the company that you keep. You have to be judged by the people who fund you. I just need to say this, David. Okay. You have to be judged by the people who fund you. If people provide your money and you provide support for them,
Nothing that you've said implies that the campaign against anti-Semitism are being... You said they've got links with this people who once platformed this person, who's a terrible bloke. We can do that with everything. I'm afraid we could do it with you, Saida, because you are accused of having links to various Muslim organisations that, you know, you say, but I just happened to be there, I was just sitting with these people, etc., etc.
That's not true, David. That's not true, because I actually think you have to deal with these on a basis of fact. And every single accusation that's ever been made about me, I have either challenged it, openly asked to debate it, or sued people and they've had to back down.
Okay, well, I'm sure that's true, but people still say it about you, right? And people will say it about this guy, not aware that he's actually funded by any of these people. He may, you know, there was a picture of him standing...
No, he is, David. David, he is... The campaign against anti-Semitism is funded by the Jewish National Fund. That's on record. All of this stuff, by the way, is at the Charity Commission in Company's house. This isn't just...
But the JNF...
We have to be really careful.
Yes, we do have to be careful. The JNF are not this... I've never heard of Hashemer, which I won't say the right way because I've never heard of it. So the point is you went through about four different steps to get to Ben Gavir, right? And that you can do that with anything. You can get to someone terrible. And I think Gideon Falter is a provocateur. And I think he's doing it for all sorts of reasons, probably mainly his strange psychology, I think. The point is that I am much more interested in discussing what actually happened than the backstories of everyone else involved. He could have done worse things. Right? I don't like him. Do you want me to say that out loud? I don't like him. He seems to me like someone whose interests are not always straightforward and that he is acting in bad faith. What he revealed, it could have been anyone doing that, is still important. Right?
I agree with you on the amount
of you doing family trees to bad people that he's involved with will change my mind. And it wouldn't change my mind about anything else, by the way. This person stood with that person, so we should have nothing to do with them. It's a very internet thing that there's an endless sense of like, oh, but we found a photograph of this person with them. And I didn't agree with them when it happened to Corbyn, right?
It's important because Gideon has been going on broadcast channels over the last few days, presenting himself as this, I'm just this ordinary guy who was walking around here with my yarmulke on. And I was then approached in this way. And he's projecting himself as an innocent bystander.
This is my position. He could be fucking Mossad's James Bond, as far as I'm concerned. And as long as the policeman did not know that and thought he was just a guy who was wearing a yarmulke, as long as that policeman thought he was an ordinary Jew trying to walk across the road, the policeman's actions are still open for discussion.
That I agree with.
It is true that there is an issue with both the policing and the intimidation felt by Jews, and he has brought that out, whether or not he is totally someone who is operating in bad faith. That is my point. By the way, other videos have emerged of Gideon Falter not trying to just walk across the road, but deliberately trying to walk in the face of the crowd. There's an earlier video in which he's in a van and he tries to drive against the crowd. So it's clear that Gideon Falter is trying to create trouble for the police against the pro-Palestinian marchers. I still think that there is an issue which, as a Jew, I'm trying to talk about here, which is difficult. I'm finding it difficult to talk about, which is I know that there are people who feel intimidated just as ordinary Jews. And particularly, I think there's an issue with this notion that you're fine as Jews as long as you come along with, you know, the opinions that we need you to have as Jews, because I think that's problematic.
I disagree with you for a number of reasons there. One, because Gideon Falter has for months and months been trying to shut down the protests. In fact, at one point, he asked the Home Secretary to send in the army. Secondly, if what Gideon Falter is saying is the only reason he was stopped is because he was visibly Jewish, not because he was actually behaving in this confrontational way and provocative way with the police, there are many people on those marches who are visibly Jewish. So clearly, just being visibly Jewish is not a reason to be at threat or to be a threat in any way, shape or form, or to be kept away from those marches.
Again, that's the lawyer in you slightly shifting the goalposts. There are many people on those marches who are visibly Jewish, but they are the ones who are waving the correct flags and holding the right placards and part of a Jewish
bloc. All of them do, by the way, David.
Well,
not all of them. Not every single Jewish person, by the way, on that waves, you know, a Namod flag or waves any other flag. There are people just on there, just Jewish, being Jewish, walking in that and not even actually walking as part of the Jewish bloc. I have Jewish friends who go on those marches with their family who don't march as part of the Jewish bloc or some banner organization. They're just Jewish people who want peace.
Yes.
So well, I think it's really important that there isn't just a bloc of Jewish people. There is a diversity of Jewish opinion.
Yes.
Shall I give you an example?
I'm not
I want to give
with
you
that.
This example, David, okay. Right? I'll tell you what happened today. It's a really personal thing that happened this week. I was on my way to London and a chap came over to me, said hello. And I said, oh, what are you doing here? Because he was a southerner. What are you doing in the north? And he said, I've come to see my mum. I'm coming to see her for Passover. And I said, oh, at a railway station. He said, yeah, my family, because of my views on Palestine and Israel, aren't comfortable with me being at the Passover family gatherings. And I just reached out to him, David, and I gave him a big hug. And I said to him, look, the easiest thing sometimes is to stick within our tribes. The hardest thing is to reach across those divides. But, you know, I sat on the train and I rang my husband and I said, British Muslims need to know, other people need to know that the diversity of opinion within British Jewish community is there, that these are not tribes and these are not blocks, that people do think about these things in a variety of different ways.
Obviously, I agree with that. And it's a lovely story about the guy at the railway. I'm saying something really simple here. There was a tell in what she said, is that there are Jews marching who just want peace. All Jews want peace, but some Jews don't want peace in the same way that perhaps the marchers do, which is an immediate ceasefire by the Israelis without any sense of a negotiated ceasefire with Hamas. And some Jews, by the way, want peace, but they're just not sure about the way that they might be done on the marches. And some Jews may just be like, maybe in the don't know category. All Jews who are not convinced that the way to do it is to protest for Palestine. And by the way, I'm more on the side of those Jews, but I hear the other Jews. All Jews who are not on that side, who might be visibly Jewish in whatever way, will be slightly intimidated by going to those marches or being around those. I know because I am visibly Jewish, because I'm me. And I know that when I go to Chelsea every Saturday, I think, oh, I'll just avoid the marches because I don't want to get into some kind of thing with the marches where I have to feel that I have to put my cards on the table about my position on that, because maybe my position on that is fluid and uncertain and whatever, and that's not going to be easy. You know, that's just what happens. There's just a whole series of complexities that happen when those people are going through London. Now, I think the way that Gideon Falter tried to bring that out was clunky and bad-faced and all sorts of things. But I do know that some Jews will have thought, I don't like the cut of his jib much, but that does still represent a bit how I feel in central London.
But I think what I think of Gideon Falter, or what I think of the CAA, is less important. What I think is really strong voices from within the Jewish community, like the Black Jewish Alliance, like the Board of Deputies in the past, like Dame Margaret Hodge, you know, Lord Mann, who is the government's advisor, independent advisor on anti-Semitism, they've all raised concerns. And where people who care about anti-Semitism are raising concerns about the campaign against anti-Semitism and Gideon Falter, I think we should stand up and we should sit up and listen.
Yeah, I think so too. But I think that you can be a person with all sorts of things wrong with you who still, I mean, really, at some level, I'm interested in the whole thing in a very amoral way, which is that just as a piece of provocation, a piece of political theatre that got the whole issue of whether or not you can be walking about with a yarmulke on and not be part of these marches and what that means and how the police might react, it got that very much into the conversation. And as such, I think it's good that we're continuing to talk about it and we can have all the back information about how much, you know, the campaign against anti-Semitism is involved in things that are a bit dodgy as we like. I still think it's good that conversation is being had.
I agree with you. And it also has a read across, actually, to what's happening in the United States at the moment with the University of Columbia. So this is a university in the United States where a number of students have been involved in peace protests. They say they started engaging in these protests and this kind of encampment because a number of student bodies were banned, including actually Jewish student bodies. Jewish Voice for Peace was one of the organizations that was banned. And that they are effectively asking their university to, first of all, divest, to declare where their money is coming from, to declare where their money is invested, and to take a position in relation to what's happening in Israel and Gaza. This is against the backdrop of congressional hearings that are taking place at the moment against universities in the United States, accusing them of creating a hostile environment where anti-Semitism is a real challenge on university campuses. And this very issue, David, has come up again, where these protesters have been painted as, in fact, one Israeli academic called them the Hitler Youth. And Jewish groups are saying, we are at these protests. We are leading some of these protests. Why are you effectively blocking out our involvement in this? And it also resulted in concerns being raised that pro-Israeli organizations were embedding the provocateur in these protests. They put this out quite publicly. They said they wanted people to go in behind enemy lines, inverted commas. And so I think it is
so the person
really
you're referring
important.
To is Shay Davidi, I think, who is a professor at Columbia, who is Israeli. And I've seen a little bit of what he's talking about. He's now not being allowed on campus himself in terms of this idea that the power all lies with the pro-Israelis. He's been banned from campus. And I don't know much about him. I've seen him doing a lot of shouting outside Columbia. I've also seen a lot of shouting from inside Columbia. Of course, one of the issues with this stuff is, as indeed with Gideon Falter, is a lot of it now, because of the fragmented social media world we live in, is based on individual films that you might get to see and which ones you might choose to focus on. So within the world of sort of Jewish online anxiety, there's an awful lot of films of people in Columbia shouting at the Jewish students, some of whom are pro-Israel, yes, but shouting at them things like, go back to Poland, and you've never had any culture, and Hamas, Hamas, make us proud. I'm particularly interested in go back to Poland and you've never had any culture, because about two podcasts ago, I said one of the ways in which you can tell the difference between anti-Zionism and anti-Semitism is look for the historical trope. Right. So go back to Poland is clearly a shout that is to do with a perceived Jewishness and an idea of Jewishness as being associated with kind of Eastern European and sort of rootless cosmopolitans by saying you've got no culture, and not to do with any sense of Israel and whatever Israel might be doing. Obviously, there's loads of other shouting to do with occupiers and all the rest of it. I think that what the thing that I heard most recently was that the rabbi, who is not Israeli, but they have a rabbi on Columbia, sent a WhatsApp message telling Jewish students that they shouldn't come into campus because it's too dangerous. Now, all of that comes back to the whole issue, as you've often said, of objective ideas of safety and a feeling or a perception of safety or not safety. What I guess I think is that I have sympathy, as you know, I have more sympathy with the Palestine cause than not with the Palestine cause. But I think as the person on this podcast who is Jewish, what I guess I'm alive to is how the particularly things like chanting and other types of enactment of solidarity for Palestine does spill over from time to time into things that are intimidating for Jews. Go back to Poland is a very good example of it. And I think that is taken as kind of collateral damage. I think there's a sense within the progressive discourse that some stuff will be said that will be upsetting to Jews. That's just, we just have to price that in. And maybe they do. Maybe that is just, you know, we can't police the tone of every protest, perhaps.
No. Shai Davidai, who you mentioned, by the way, his big issue, again, a bit like Gideon Falter was, that the university had provided two separate lawns, actually. I think the West lawn for the Palestinian encampment and the math lawn, I think, for the pro-Israeli. And what he was trying to do was get onto the West lawn, and he was being stopped from doing so. So it was a kind of a provocateur approach. But one of the words that he's used for the pro-Palestinian peace encampment there, which includes lots of Jews, is, you know, they're not kids, they're terrorists. And he refers to them as, and I hope I pronounce this right, Judenrat Kapos. In an open letter by the arrested and suspended Jewish students of Columbia University, they said the following, open quotes, "The disgraceful Shai Davidai publicly called us Judenrat Kapos and told us we would be on the last train to Auschwitz. We do not feel safe with Professor still teaching on our campus, having access to the Jewish community spaces we cherish, much less portraying himself as the valiant protector and spokesperson of Jews on campus while insulting our ancestors' memory. Almost every suspended Jewish student lost family members in the Holocaust. We have been called many things during our time at Columbia. This was the worst." David, what is Judenrat and Kapo?
For anyone who doesn't know, Judenrat was the name the Nazis gave to small organisations of Jews who they allowed to oversee ghettos while they were liquidating them, and they would save the lives of those Jews for a short amount of time, but mainly they would kill them later, so they were sort of collaborators. And Kapos, similarly, were Jews who in concentration camps would work for the Nazis, mainly funnelling Jews into gas chambers and then, you know, burning their bodies afterwards, just because that meant that they would again live for slightly longer. They're insults based on Jews who, for the sake of prolonging their lives a little bit longer, help the Nazis in various ways with their industrial massacres.
If you call somebody Judenrat or Kapo, is that anti-Semitic, David?
It depends. Depends who it is and in what context. Actually, I don't know if it's anti-Semitic. I suppose. It's a really good question. I think it is, but it's so complicated because you're talking about an Israeli Jew calling anti-Zionist Jews that. I think that's a whole question for a whole other podcast.
I think it's so important, though, for this podcast, David, because I think it raises this issue of how complicated it is to say what is and what isn't anti-Semitism and what isn't Islamophobia.
I think the use, as I say, I think as we both discussed, I think the use of the Nazi comparison in almost any situation is a bad one. It just... To be honest with you, I think it is almost always anti-Semitic to use the Nazis as a comparison for almost anything because it belittles what the Nazis were doing in comparison to whatever it is that the person is talking about. So on any side, I would say there's always an anti-Semitic element to that comparison.
And what they're also saying, which I think this is really important because it goes back to Judaism, Jewish students are saying that they have raised concerns about anti-Semitism on campus because the university has created an environment where they don't now have access to facilities for Jewish religious observance. You know, when during Passover, during Shabbat, during other moments, they found it really difficult to be able to practice their Judaism. And what they're saying is if the university or, you know, people like this guy, Davidai, is really interested in Jewish students and Jewishness, then why is it that they're not concerned about the fact that Jewish students, because of the way the university is behaving, can't practice their Jewishness? And that's the distinction between, is anti-Semitism anti-Jewish racism, or is anti-Semitism used as a way to stop criticism, any criticism of Israel?
One of the things that I just wanted to mention as well is that I believe the person shouting "Go back to Poland," who was wearing sort of almost full Hamas gear, was not Muslim. I believe it was a white person. And actually, most of the aggression towards Gideon Falter that was happening in the margins of his conversation with the police was also not coming from Muslims. I'm always interested in how much some of the sort of extremes that we see go on all sides of this marches are happening from people who are, you know, not neither Jewish nor Muslim. In fact, we can go on to talk about this now, but the video that emerged of a guy abusing some people who were coming back from a march, abusing some Muslim women, again, he wasn't Jewish. So there's a way in which the sort of antagonism, the energy of this antagonism, is just taken up by people who want to be in the fight in a way that I think is always unhelpful.
I think there's no doubt that the overwhelming amount of anti-Semitism that Jewish communities face in the United Kingdom and the overwhelming amount of Islamophobia and anti-Muslim sentiment that Muslims face in the United Kingdom is not directed at them by Jews or Muslims. It's directed at them by white, extreme, far-right, you know, racists.
Spring is my favorite time to start a new workout routine. With the weather warming up, it feels easier to get into the rhythm of things. Whether you have 20 minutes or an hour for a Pilates class or outdoor guided walk, Peloton has everything you need to help you get going. Get a head start on summer with Peloton at onepeloton.com.
So I want to talk about this video that's doing the rounds of this man shouting at two women, Muslim women, who look like they've just come back from a Palestinian peace march. It was actually quite an uncomfortable watch because he physically gets really quite close to them. And I suppose what for me, I suppose, made it quite personal was that this week there was another report by a think tank, Policy Exchange, who's now done four reports on the issue of Islamophobia. They are utterly obsessed with this. And what they have done is put down a whole list of examples which they say are not Islamophobia. And they say, because these examples are not Islamophobia, therefore we must not have a definition of Islamophobia. First of all, I thought that was a really bonkers argument to be making, because just because I could go out and find half a dozen examples which somebody has said is anti-Semitism, but clearly is not, does not mean we should not have a definition of anti-Semitism. But also what concerned me about this report was that not only was this the fourth report they were doing on this, they are utterly obsessed about this, but this report comes under a series of reports that they do about Muslims, which is all about the securitization of Muslims. And so they have different sections in their research work that they do, and they have a section on kind of community cohesion. But actually, all the stuff about Muslims falls into this securitization section, because that's the way that they see Muslims. Now, you're probably going to say to me, David, which is, who the hell is this think tank?
I'm not actually. But this might surprise you, Saida. I've read the policy document. Now, I know my position on this podcast is, oh, God, Saida's talking about politics. She's talking about Westminster. I'm not interested. But I am in Delhi and I can't sleep because I'm jet lagged. And I found myself reading the policy document because it was on our notes and I clicked onto it. So let's just explain a few things about it, because I actually have read it, as I said. So it's written, co-written by Khalid Mahmood, is that correct? Who is a Labour MP who you've had a bit of a spat with on Twitter about this document. There, it's got a preface by Sajid Javid. So there are Muslims involved. There are other people who co-wrote it who are not Muslim, but there are Muslims involved. You know, it's worth saying, in terms of the point you were making about the diversity of opinion in the Jewish community, is that there's a diversity of opinion in the Muslim community, some of whom don't share your opinion, for example, that a definition of Islamophobia is required. I read the document and so this is quite hard because I am, as you know, of the opinion that it's up to a minority to define what the racism against themselves is. And you are the Muslim on this podcast, so I don't want to tell you what Islamophobia is. But there are Muslims who have written this document And I'm happy to at least listen to them in order to have a conversation about it. One of the things they do is they give examples, which is interesting in terms of you saying that anti-Semitism, as the campaign against anti-Semitism were doing it, is weaponizing anti-Semitism to include all sorts of things that might not be anti-Semitic, and that's happening at Columbia. They give loads of examples of that in this. That's their methodology, is to say, this is being called Islamophobic and this is being called Islamophobic. Two of them involve Jews, so I think that's worth mentioning, or they involve Israel and Jews. One is that asking an MP to agree that terrorists should attack fewer people is Islamophobic, which is a slightly incendiary way of saying that when Zara Sultana, the Labour MP, asked Rishi Sunak if he would seek to de-escalate the situation in the Middle East and call for immediate ceasefire, he said perhaps the Honourable Lady would do well to call on Hamas and the Houthis to de-escalate the situation. The Labour Muslim Network said asking a Muslim member of parliament to talk about Hamas and escalation in Gaza is clearly Islamophobia. So there's lots of other examples. I'd like to know, because actually I don't know the answer, do you as a Muslim think that Rishi Sunak's answer to Zara Sultana is Islamophobic, as it was described on the Labour Muslim Network? Is the Prime Minister demanding a Muslim member of parliament call on Hamas to de-escalate in Gaza is clear Islamophobia? Do you think it is?
I think it's really disturbing that if a Muslim member of parliament or a Jewish member of parliament asks the Prime Minister a specific issue on a foreign policy issue and he makes it tribal about them. So if a Jewish member of parliament said to the Prime Minister, will he condemn the people who were around the aid trucks trying to grab the aid when it went into Gaza? And the Prime Minister turned around and said, I'd ask the Honourable Gentleman to condemn the Israeli Defence Force and Netanyahu. If that's his answer, rather than engaging with the actual question, I would say, whoa, why would you say that to a Jewish Member of Parliament? Why would you get them to be accountable for Netanyahu and the Israeli Defence Force? Okay. What, just because they're Jewish?
Okay,
so I do think there's something distasteful about the way in which he framed that. There's a series of tests that Professor Modood from the University of Bristol has set out when he said they provide a helpful prism for drawing a distinction between what is legitimate debate and what is targeted racism, and he goes through a whole series of tests. So Professor Modood says, does the criticism stereotype Muslims by assuming they all think the same? Does the criticism seem to suggest that all or most Muslims have this blameworthy characteristic and that feature defines Muslims? Indeed, it drowns out any worthy characteristics and ignores contextual factors. Does the criticism consist of generalization? Does it consist of excluding the group? So it's all about stereotyping, stigmatizing, and putting tropes on that community. Yeah. That's racism.
Yeah.
My hack always is replace the example with a different community and see if it still feels comfortable. And if it doesn't, the chances are it's racism.
So you're in the report, or you're in the think tank thing mentioned, because you were, did you actually chair it, the AAPG, the All Party Parliamentary
No.
Group? Okay, but you were on the 2018-2019 committee that... of that?
I was on the group of about, I think it was a couple of dozen parliamentarians who were part of that. It was chaired by Wes Streeting, the now Shadow Health Secretary, and Anna Soubry, the ex-Conservative Defence Minister. And what's fascinating in this report is, and it says this right at the outset, the reason for this fourth kind of hatchet job of the Islamophobia report by Policy Exchange is because they're concerned that Wes Streeting is likely to be a big part of the new government that's formed okay. after the next general election. And they're trying to say to him, please don't do anything around this area to provide this kind of protection
right.
definition.
Okay. I mean, you know, who knows whether the Policy Exchange document will have any effect at all on the new government.
They're really powerful, but, David, right?
Well, okay.
So this is why it's important. If they were just a two-bit nothingness, they're one, really well-funded, secondly, opaquely funded, which is constantly talked about in the list of where their money comes from and how they declare it. But thirdly, they are incredibly powerful. Almost anybody who takes a leadership position within the Conservative Party has either been or worked with them. The Prime Minister's worked with them. Most people who work for the Prime Minister have worked for them. So they have really deep roots and tentacles into the party. And actually, by the way, they don't make a secret of this. They boast about their influence and power within
okay.
conservative policymaking.
Okay. I just want to ask, and I should say I'm asking this slightly just wanting to clarify intellectually things that I think you will be clearer about. It mentions in the document that the All-Party Parliamentary Group in 2018 on British Muslims said the supposed right to criticise Islam results in nothing more than another subtle form of anti-Muslim racism. Now, that's interesting because I guess that's where the people writing this are trying to hone in on, which is the idea that, you know, liberal values such as the ability to criticize religion of all sorts, to criticize faith, to make fun of faith, should not be called a type of racism. But the APG say in their report that the supposed right to criticize Islam results in another subtle form of anti-Muslim racism.
That's absolute BS.
It doesn't say
I'm that. I'm involved in that report.
That's a direct quote.
And on the face of the report, it says this definition and this work on Islamophobia is in no way and does not in any way stop debate and discussion about Islam. And in fact, we went further than that. We actually got a ruling from a Cambridge academic called Professor Tim Winters, who's actually also a Muslim. He basically gave us a ruling to say that there's a long history of debate, discussion and disagreement and questioning of Islam throughout history, so that this definition... I mean, think about it like this, David. Let me give you a really personal example. If somebody decides that their interpretation of Islam is that I should be dressed in a certain way, and if I'm not dressed in that certain way, then I'm not practicing my faith properly, and they want to implement that somehow through legislation, what the hell? Do I want to live my life like that? Do I want religious men? Do I want imams to be telling me how I should be living my life? Of course I don't. You know, I am one of the most open out there liberal thinkers on women's rights, on LGBT rights.
But you accept...
I'm pushing the debate within the community on this.
No, I know you are. A lot of what it's saying is, and it won't be you, it's finding examples of God knows where of Islamophobia being used to shut down X, Y, Z. One of the things that it uses is liberal critique of Islam. So it uses that as one of the examples that talking about whether it's okay for women to wear burqas or for the whole idea of what women should or shouldn't wear as being a liberal thing that liberals like to talk about, it finds... people saying that that's Islamophobic. And it wouldn't be wrong to say that there probably are some people who do consider that Islamophobic.
There probably are people out there who would say your criticism of my version of my faith in this way is considered to be anti-Muslim racism. But that's not what the Islamophobia definition does.
Yeah.
But actually saying, I don't believe in the fact that women should dress like that or behave like that or prayer should be like that or, you know, these history figures should be treated in that way. That's got nothing to do with Islamophobia.
Now, the point about all this is, you were talking earlier, and I, by the way, agree with you in certain cases. You were talking earlier about the weaponization of anti-Semitism by bad faith actors and by the state of Israel, which obviously does happen. Mm-hmm. And I completely agree with you. Now, I think...
I also think there's the weaponization of Islamophobia, David,
okay,
by bad faith actors.
So when does that happen?
I'll give you an example. For me, Islamophobia or anti... I don't even like the word Islamophobia, right? The word I always use is anti-Muslim racism. The reason that the word Islamophobia is used is because when the All-Party Parliamentary Group went out and took evidence across the country, the word that most British Muslims said they wanted us to use was Islamophobia, right? So it's the community wants this word, even though it's not a perfect word and it's not a word that I like. I would use anti-Muslim racism and anti-Jewish racism. You can never use Islamophobia or anti-Muslim racism as an accusation to shut down debate about Islam. It's not there to protect a faith. It's there to protect believers or perceived believers. And there are people who would like to use it to protect a belief system. But a belief system is so diverse and everybody's interpretation is different. And we're not here to introduce, you know, blasphemy laws have long gone from these shores and we never want them back. There are bad faith actors, both Muslim bad faith actors, who will use the accusation of Islamophobia to shut down debate about Islam. And there are bad faith actors within the Jewish community who will use the accusation of anti-Semitism to shut down debate about Israel. My objection to this report is that that Policy Exchange, who in the past when writing about Muslims have been found by BBC Newsnight to be bad faith actors, that actually they are obsessed with this issue and at no point have they ever said, actually, we don't think this definition is the right definition, but we think this is the way to protect British Muslims.
Okay, so...
And if you don't ever have an answer, if you don't ever have an answer about how you would protect this community, then I'm sorry, you're constantly sniping at it to stop anybody else providing any form of protection means that you do not have a locus in this, in the way in which you're trying to influence this debate.
Okay, that might be right. I, as it happens, I'm not a big fan of the IHRA definition. I'm not the big fan of definitions of racism in general. What I think is that the minority involved are able to see racism when it happens and they can call it out. And often that involves deconstructing exactly what tropes are being used in this specific example. And it's very hard to have a generalised map of what is anti-Semitism. I've read the IHRI definition a number of times. That's the definition put forward by the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance, the one that's mainly accepted by the government and indeed by the Labour Party. And I thought I could give you 17 examples of anti-Semitism that are not covered by this definition. And there are some in the, whatever it is, regulations that I think aren't particularly anti-Semitic. I want to ask you just one more thing, which is the conclusion of the APPG report that I've read here, and in fact this bit involves you being quoted or your name coming up, as the definition that you came up with in 2018 was non-legally binding and would protect believers, not beliefs. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm really interested in that because I'm not sure where the grey area exactly is, because I think my issue is intellectually, is if you say I'm trying to protect a believer, not a belief, if that was a Jew, and they say, I'm just trying to protect a believer, not your belief, you're allowed to say what you like about Hashem, which is the Jewish word for God, but I'm going to make fun of him, I'm going to make fun of God, but I'm not going to make fun of you as a person. I think most believers would say, well, I feel so identified with that belief that you are making fun of me. So I think it's a very complicated distinction.
Yeah, which is why the definition, and I'll tell you what the definition is, that Islamophobia is a form of racism that targets expressions of Muslimness or perceived Muslimness. And by the way, that definition then has a whole load of examples underneath it, just like the IHRA definition, because these things are not black and white. And what we made sure was that this was, one, a non-legally binding definition. And so it's not, we're not going to apply the law on people. Secondly, that it's a working definition like the IHRA, which is that it's a constantly evolving definition. I think what the IHRA definition does on anti-Semitism, David, and what the APPG definition on Islamophobia does is it sets a direction of travel. I see as nudge behaviour. It's a measure that you could look against and say, is what my organisation or my institution doing, or me, am I personally doing, likely to fall foul of this? If it is, maybe I just need to think again. I don't like applying the law. I'm actually a libertarian at heart. I think the law should be the last thing that you apply. What you should try and do is make culture change by making people think again and not use the kind of terms that in the past we used to use, the N-word or the P-word. And these definitions are simply about Britain carrying on its progressive journey towards being more understanding and liberal and inclusive.
Okay, fine. I'm just not sure definitions are always the way. And I find it hard to believe that if a definition did exist, that it wouldn't be used legally, that people wouldn't sue people using it as a definition. But maybe you're right that a non-binding definition is a way forward, for at least for people to talk about. I'm still not sure you've answered this question about what is the difference between a believer and a set of beliefs. It seems to me that particularly now, when people are so convinced that their identity is wrapped up in what they believe, and you see it online all the time, if you challenge someone's belief, they feel personally attacked. I'm not sure it really works to say we're trying to create a definition that protects believers, not beliefs. That's an intellectual problem I have with it, not really anything to do with Muslims and Jews.
Yeah, and I think the same was said about the IHRA definition, that actually it wasn't clear enough, and those demarcations between when are you attacking somebody because they're Jewish or when are you attacking Israel and that's impacting on their Jewish identity, for whom people feel that their Jewish identity is intrinsically linked to the state of Israel.
Yeah, or religion.
And people
or their
had
religion.
Huge rows about this.
Or yeah. Their religion.
And people had huge rows about this, you know, but I think in the end, I think if you are good faith people who genuinely care about fighting racism and making people feel included, we can find a way to this. And the definitions, whether it's anti-Semitism and Islamophobia, are just one of the tools that we can use.
I'm in India. I'm reading my kids' books to schools in Delhi and Mumbai, but that's a whole other conversation we could have about the way India has gone in terms of Hindu nationalism. Let's not do that now. Let's leave it for another week. And maybe just because I'm in India, you can teach me a word in Urdu.
You know, I might start teaching you Yiddish, because this week, a lovely gentleman by the name of Paul Slade sent me a book called The Joys of Yiddish by Leo Rosten. And he basically said to me, I think he's basically Team Varsi, and he said, I'm sending you this so that every so often you can surprise David. And the word he wants me to say to you today is plots.
Plots. I think it's Plutz. I think it's
P-L-O-T-Z. So basically the whole point of this book from Paul is that I'm going to start using Yiddish words and you will Plutz.
Yeah. The way I see it, Saida, is there isn't Team Badil and Team Varsi. There's just Team a Muslim and a Jew go there.
I agree. So let me ask you a question. What word have you heard in India that you now know but you didn't know before?
None at all so far, because I've only been here a day and most of the words I pick up on are words in English in the middle of people speaking Hindi.
So I was watching this really interesting TikTok video and they were saying that the only two words you need to know when you're in India is bhai, which is brother, and hai, which is. So you just have to walk into everything and say bhai, Wi-Fi hai, which basically okay. means do you have Wi-Fi? Bhai, you know, food hai, bhai, chicken masala hai. So just learn bhai and hai and you're going to be fine. Yeah.
Okay, have we done it now?
In a couple of weeks, we're going to be doing another Q&A session. So we'd like you to send in your questions. The email address is podcast@instinctproductions.com.
And you can also send us questions or any comments you like, including horrible trolling, on @AMuslimAndAJew on Twitter. Muslim and a Jew Go There was brought to you by Instinct Productions.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your processes to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. Schedule package pickups and see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers. With rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up with code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's Stamps.com. Code Program.